Now, The White Bungalow. That's the title of the final yarn in our week's selection of short stories by A.J. Allen. It's read by Ian Carmichael.
Good morning. The place we go to every year for our summer holiday is called Littlebury-on-Sea. It's about 17 miles from Plymouth. It isn't exactly a village, but just a collection of 40 or 50 bungalows dotted about on the edge of the cliff. There's a shop, of course, which is also the post office, and opening out of the post office is a highly efficient telephone exchange, 6 feet by 3. As you can imagine, one rather leads the simple life down there, and no one, at least no one who is anyone, wears anything but rags. A man certainly once did appear in decent clothes, but his body was found floating some days afterwards. We even occasionally take in each other's washing. Not in the usually accepted sense, but what I mean is that if you see the paper man trying to deliver a suspicious-looking bundle next door, when you know they're out, you harbour it until they come in. Well, that's the sort of place it is, and no ceremony to speak of is stood on. Anyway, we have taken a bungalow there for a great many years. As a general rule, the day after we get down and the unpacking's finished, my wife and I make a little tour of inspection. We go, first of all, and pay our respects to Mr. and Mrs. Jupp at the post office, and then we stroll round to see what's been altered or built since the summer before. Well, we did that this year, and after we'd thoroughly inspected Littlebury-on-Sea, we wandered along the cliff and down into the next cove called Folliborough. There are bungalows there, too, and we found a brand new one, standing rather by itself. It was all painted white and evidently only just finished. We walked round outside the fence and admired it. And as we were walking round and admiring it, we both noticed that the telephone bell was ringing. And it went on and on and on. Well, my wife, who was an extremely tidy woman, said, I wish they'd answer their telephone. But no one did. When we finally came to the conclusion that everyone was out. That being so, it seemed a bit callous to go away and let poor Miss Lynx up at the exchange go on ringing, so I said, I shall go in and tell her that there's no one at home, which I proceeded to do. I walked up the garden path and in at the front door. It was wide open. People don't shut their front doors down there, and it led straight into a big living room. I looked round for the telephone and eventually found it on a writing table tucked away in a sort of alcove. It was a pretty room, rather irregular in shape. This writing table had the usual things on it. Big stand, calendar, clock, and so on. And in the pen tray there were some pencils. The clock was right, and the pencils were properly sharpened. So I imagined it to be a man's writing table. I took off the telephone receiver and heard a confused sort of noise going on, which meant I was onto a trunk line and not just the local exchange. I said hello at intervals, and while I waited, I picked up one of the pencils and made a note of the time. So, as it was exactly 5:45, I wrote down the figures 17:45 on the top left-hand corner of a clean white blotting pad which was on the table. Well, I went on saying hello and getting no answer, when suddenly a woman's voice cut in. It struck me that she was rather agitated. She said, is that the white bungalow? Well, I said, it's certainly a white bungalow, and quite possibly the white bungalow, but there's no one in, and I'm only just answering the telephone. And then she said, are you at Folliborough? Still more agitated. And I told her that I was, and then she said, will you go up at once to the Coast Guard station and tell them there's been an accident? A little girl has fallen off the chair rock and is lying unconscious just below it. The tide's coming in, and if they aren't quick, she'll be drowned. I said, right, and I slammed down the receiver and ran out to my missus, who was still standing by the garden gate, and I told her what the situation was. Now, look, by the way, I think I ought to explain a little bit what the coast beyond Folliborough is like. It's very wild, indeed, and people only go along there for prawning. The cliffs are over 200 feet high, and the beach is merely a mass of big rocks. The beach is rather divided off into sections by buttresses of cliff which stick out. You can get past them till about 3/4 tide, and then you can't. The chair rock, which I knew quite well, where the accident had happened, was at the end of the first section from Folliborough Cove, where we were. We had a look at the tide and saw that it wasn't quite up to the foot of the first buttress, and there was still just time to get round, so we decided that the best thing to do was for me to go straight for the place along the beach, while she, my wife that is, went back into Folloborough village and collected some coast guards and ropes and things. They would have to follow along the top of the cliffs. At all events, I scrambled along for something like half a mile over slimy boulders and in and out of pools, and finally got to this chair rock. At the foot of it, there's a large, flat slab, and on it was lying the daintiest little maiden you ever saw. She was as pretty as a picture, in spite of the fact that she had a bump on her forehead the size of a golf ball. I reckon she must have taken a toss from at least 15 feet up. She was completely unconscious, anyway. It was a good thing I hurried, because the waves were beginning to wash over her, and I picked her up as carefully as I could and waded ashore. There was a convenient patch of shingle at high water mark, and I deposited her on that. I hunted for broken bones and further damage and couldn't find any, so it wasn't a very serious accident after all, but it easily might have been. Now, what I mean is, supposing you're only stunned, if you're drowned before you recover, you're just as dead as if you'd been killed. Another few minutes and she'd have been an angel. However, she wasn't. Well, soon after I'd put her down, she opened her eyes and tried to sit up. She didn't say, "Where am I?" or anything like that. She simply asked, "What have you done with my prawns?" I said, "I haven't seen your prawns, and in any case, they don't matter a... Well, they don't matter." And I adjured her to lie down and not to fuss. But, oh, that wouldn't do. She wanted her prawns there and then. She'd gone out specially to get them for her daddy's supper, and nothing would satisfy her but the immediate production of these, beasts. She told me exactly what they were like. They were in a tin, apparently, and three in number. And one of them had longer whiskers than the other two. But I said, never mind about their whiskers, I shall know them by their tin. And I promised that if she'd stop quite still, I'd go back to the rocks and have a good look. Well, she gave me her word not to move, and I waded forth into the breakers on what looked like a perfectly hopeless quest. But I know you won't believe me. I found this tin bobbing up and down about 20 yards out. Yes. The only thing was that its three occupants were shrimps, not prawns, so I wouldn't have told her so for all the world. At the age of 6, one's shrimps are apt to be prawns. Well, just then there were loud cries from the top of the cliff, and presently a coast guard came slithering down on a bosun's chair on the end of a rope. We conferred, and then we tied the young woman into the bosun's chair and sent her up first, complete with courtesy prawns. And she howled with glee all the way up. Then I went, and finally the coast guard. At the top, I found my wife and 4 more coast guards. The distressed heroine was beginning to feel a little sick, so as they brought a stretcher, we thought it safer to put her on it and keep her there until the doctor had seen her. Actually, I wasn't allowed to take part in the triumphal procession. My missus told me that I was sopping wet and must run home and change, which I did. However, when she got back to our bungalow about an hour later, she said the patient was doing well. They'd first of all taken her to the Coast Guard station, where she'd been overhauled by a doctor. He said that bar the crack on the head and a certain amount of shock, she hadn't come to any harm. They were going to take her home after she'd had a bit of a rest. Then my wife said, "It's rather funny about where she lives." And she said, "Well, she comes from that white bungalow where you answer the telephone." Well, I agreed it was a bit of a coincidence, although really, when you come to think of it, she'd got to live somewhere. There was no earthly reason why it shouldn't have been there, just as well as anywhere else. It wasn't even strange about the message, or our not knowing who'd sent it. If it was anyone out walking along the cliff from the other direction who'd spotted the girl from above, well, the first thing that would have occurred to them would be to run back the way they'd come, to give the alarm. And that would account for our not having come across them. Well, we didn't worry our heads any more about it, but after dinner, when we were out for another stroll, we thought it would be rather polite to go down and inquire after the patient, so we did. The parents were in by this time, quite nice people, and they told us that Susan was in bed and asleep, and developing a lovely black eye, but otherwise going on quite well. Then the mother said, "Are you by any chance the Good Samaritans who rescued her?" We hastily assured her that there hadn't been anything in the nature of rescue work. It had merely been a question of removing their daughter a little further up the beach out of harm's way. As I pointed out, one would have done the same for any towel one had found near the edge, and she was worth quite a lot of towels. However, they insisted on being embarrassingly grateful. And then the mother turned to her husband and said, "Shall we tell them, George?" And he said, "Well, you can if you like, but they won't believe you." And then she told us quite an astonishing story. That afternoon, she and her husband had motored into Plymouth. They'd done some shopping and got their hair cut, and then they'd gone and called on the architect who designed their bungalow. I forget exactly what it was about. Something to do with the hot water, I think. Actually, she didn't go in. George went in, and she sat and waited in the car. And while she waited, she fell asleep and dreamed a dream. Well, nothing in that, of course, and it's been done before, but this was a very peculiar dream indeed, as it turned out. She dreamed that she was on the top of the cliff immediately above Chair Rock. She looked down and saw Susan spread out on the stone just below it. In fact, she described most accurately how she was lying when I found her, when the tide was coming in and all the rest of it. There she was, unable to get down or do anything to help. And yet all the time she knew herself to be miles away in Plymouth. She felt that if only she could get to a telephone, something might be done, but, well, of course, she couldn't move hand or foot, like you often can't in dreams. It must have been very, very terrible for her. I mean, the idea of wanting to telephone was so strong that when George came out and woke her, she wanted him to go back into the office again and ring up the Coast Guards at Follerborough to see if everything was all right. Well, he naturally wouldn't, and rather laughed at her. But he tried to drive home faster than he usually did. Well, unfortunately, they had engine trouble on the way and took nearly 2 hours to get back. Otherwise, my wife would have seen them. At all events, she, the mother, that is, finished up by saying, "It seems like a direct intervention of Providence that you were walking along the beach at that time." So I said, "But I wasn't walking along the beach. I got a telephone message telling me exactly where to go. Otherwise, I shouldn't have been within half a mile of the place." Well, of course, it was the first they'd heard of this, and the husband was frightfully keen to know who'd telephoned and where I was when I got the message. So I told him. I said, "I was here outside your own gates, and I heard the bell ringing, and as no one seemed to be going to answer it, I took the liberty of walking in case it was anything important. Oh, I also mentioned that I hadn't waited to get the name of the good lady who'd spoken to me." Then there was a dead silence. They both looked rather funny, and finally the man said to me, "Do you mean to tell me that you came in here and answered the telephone?" I said, "Certainly, why not?" And he said, "Because we haven't got a telephone." I said, "Oh, well, come on, don't be silly. I mean, well, I had it in my hand. I spoke into it. And I got straight up and went over to the writing table in the alcove. And do you know there wasn't a sign of a telephone and never had been? And you can bet your sweet lives I looked. But on the corner of the blotting pad, in my own handwriting, were the figures 1745.